Good morning and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. We hold two weekly meetings presently, and we're starting a new month. Today is January 5th, so the title for the month is The Path of Spiritual Evolution. And this morning's topic is the ideal and evidence of human perfectibility. Next Sunday will be Behind Will Stands Desire. And that meeting opens at 11 a.m. and runs till noon. Doors to the lodge are open at 10:30, and the book table is available before and after all meetings. Wednesday evenings, we're studying currently The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. And that meeting runs from 7:45 to 9 p.m., and there is a reference library open from 5:30 to 7:30 before the meeting weekly on Wednesdays. We have straight line theosophical material for sale. It is put forth at the cost of shipping and handling. There is no profit made. And you can always ask any volunteer if you have any questions, or if you would like to participate in this effort in a more active manner, you can check with the person at the book table. Now we'll read, being the beginning of the month, we'll read the policy of the lodge this morning. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. And that's an idea that we might explore today. All the work done at this particular lodge or any of them around the world is done on a completely voluntary basis. So that might be money, it might be work, any form of sacrifice that you can think of to help the movement is greatly appreciated. And again, you could see the person at the book table. So this morning, the ideal and evidence of human perfectibility. We're going to start with the ideal.
In this modern day and age, we would think there would be a way for the student who had this assignment to send it to us through some device or something. But in his honor, we went online and picked up some quotes from students on this very subject. And we wanted to start with Robert Crosby. back of all religions that ever have been. There is the record, the tradition of some great personage, and all the many saviors of different times and peoples taught the same fundamental ideas. This fact suggests that there is a body of men, perfected men, product of past civilizations and evolution, our elder brothers, in fact, who have acquired and are the custodians of the knowledge and experience gained through eons of time. Their knowledge is actually the very science of life, for it enters into every department of existence of nature. This knowledge they have preserved and recorded, and they have the memory of it, just as we have the memory of yesterday's experiences and events. But these perfected men are designated as our elder brothers. Well, if we are brothers to them and they are brothers to us, it means we have the same potency, the same potential, the same power, the same source. So why aren't we perfected? From the spiritual point of view, incarnation represents our imperfections, not our perfections. Once incarnated, we forget the high knowledge that we truly have in our real nature. We have within ourselves the power to evolve, but we don't know the right way to do it. And there then are those who will remind man. And those are the great teachers, the perfected beings who are not just the ideal, but as we will hear, the fact of life. One of these great teachers was Krishna. And in the 7th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, he says that there are 4 classes of people in whom he interests himself: the afflicted, the searchers for truth, those who desire possessions, and the wise. Affliction or suffering is usually the way we begin to question and wonder. Suffering usually brings us to a point where we will listen, and we will listen to someone who is willing to teach us. Those who desire possessions are learning that there are no barriers to the acquisition of whatever it is we wish, but it has to be rightly earned and then rightly used. The wise have learned that the things that we treasure in life, faith and religion, they're not secure. They are valueless in themselves and offer us the negative wisdom of knowing what not to do. Such humans, the afflicted, the searchers, are ready to assume responsibility for their own evolution and to become self-conscious evolvers, to strive towards that goal of perfectibility. A Mahatma's power of perception covers the entire manifested universe. His power of action comprehends the spiritual, the intellectual, or the physical. A Mahatma is the highest embodiment of perfectibility. And we, humans, in this cycle of evolution, have that as a goal, but only if we realize the reality of it. And to do that, we have to look to the evidence of such beings.
One that comes to mind immediately, we thought, was Gautama Buddha. Buddha being a ceremonial title, a title of importance. The story of his life is amazing. Growing up, surrounded by beauty and riches and in a palace and being of a noble birth, but not being witness to man's suffering until, as was said, the need arose in him to experience the outside world. So he climbed outside the gates of the palace walls and came upon an old and sick man. He had no idea what illness was or what old age was, because that had all been kept away from him. So he experienced for himself the suffering of humanity, going out a couple of times, and then told his wife, I choose a different path. I have to do something to alleviate this suffering. So it is said he sat and meditated under the Bodhi tree and eventually became enlightened, which is a lovely way of saying what was described earlier. And if perhaps we can go over these later, but he's got the four noble truths, and the first is that existence is suffering, and he gives the remedy for that. And once we conquer those four, there's the Eightfold Path. So we have lots of information from this soul on how to better seek the path that we wish. We wish to follow these. Now, these are all reformers who came back at the time when it was right for mankind to receive them. We're thinking of Confucius. Now we're in the 5th or 6th century BCE. And contemporary with him on the globe at the time was Lao Tzu in China, Buddha in India, Zoroaster in Persia, and Pythagoras in Greece. Imagine such a time on the earth that everywhere we looked, there was teaching, there was learning, there was sacrifice of a mental kind, a conscious effort. And the Confucianists that have said, love virtue for its own sake and try to do good unselfishly without perpetually looking to reward and profit, which we know from the Gita is the idea as well. So there were those who sought to destroy the growing power of this Confucian policy. So Confucius established a school for those who wished to study these ideas, and it said he had 3,000 scholars, but of those, only 72 were intensely interested in what needed to be done to align themselves seriously with those teachings. And it said in 517 he met Lao Tzu and told his disciples he had met a dragon. So there was a recognition of one to another that there was light in the world. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna reminds us that all tests and trials of the would-be disciple are directly related to his inner attitude, which reflects in his outer behavior. So the whole book is a recitation on how to align oneself with the ideas, how to recognize duty and carry it out faithfully. And finally, we were thinking of the character we know as Jesus, but at the time where it is said he lived, there was no one of that background on the scene. Yet about 100 years after that, we find Apollonius of Tyana being on the scene, and he's said to have lived a life closest to the stories we have of the Jesus. So born in Tyana, a Greek city, in the 1st century AD, born into an ancient and aristocratic line, much like the Buddha's story, he would forsake it all to be of service to his fellow men and to all those who were suffering. So it's the same story over and over again. The only good was moral excellence. Independence of external circumstances was needed. Wealth was an obstacle to development of virtue, because they knew that could take a hold in a different way, and become a distraction to the path. And this personage, Apollonius of Tyana, was the one to have scribes traveling with him, those who would keep the records of his journey. So we find those ideas written that we may attribute to the Jesus character. But regardless of the name, the ideas are the same and the work is the same. The great and difficult victory, the conquering of the desires of the individual soul, is a work of ages, we are told. Therefore, expect not to obtain its reward until ages of experience have been accumulated. Your thoughts? Questions? Yes.
Ages is a very, very difficult
nebulous term.
Nebulous, difficult term to imagine. We think we read somewhere where if you really are on the path, then you have, seven more lives?
Lifetimes. Yes, we think we have read that. If we are devoted, truly devoted throughout our life, it's possible that we have only seven more lifetimes to become of the nature of these.
But if is more nebulous than ages.
Yeah.
If we need the devotional books to become a scale or a ruler for us, what do we need to develop? Where are we lacking? Because we might think we're started on the path, but our nature isn't started on the path. Yes.
Well, it may take ages to get to that point where
yes.
we can start on the path. We were thinking, though, in all those examples given, in their lives, they refer to their own discipleship for a period of probation. They weren't born showing forth all that
right.
knowledge, but they had to go through a period of trial and training to bring mm-hmm. forth those abilities. So the question is then, what was the role of institutions like the mystery schools in the past for helping promote that mm-hmm. perfectibility?
Right. Well, we would say the role of the mystery schools has always been as an opportunity for those who would seek the knowledge, who would seek to become a disciple, to discipline themselves, to sacrifice what was needed, and to conquer this line of wisdom, to bring it out, as was said, to have it shine forth. So the teachings and the schools have always been available. It is up to each individual soul to seek it out, to do what's necessary. We think in Pythagoras's schools, there were years of different types of training before they actually got to sit with him and work on philosophy. And
7 years of silence, yes. But the mystery schools had an introductory level that was not for anyone seeking anything. It was sort of the popular way of introducing people to higher ideals, higher principles. And we can't remember the Greek name, but that's the veiled. So ordinary people would come and be awakened through, like, the story of is it Demeter, or is that the daughter going, the mother Persephone going into Hades to rescue her daughter? There were myths and legends that gave out in a different way to people through drama that there was more to life than what they thought. So that we're at the very beginning level, and then as one awakened, they would move up to the one that was spoken of. So the mystery schools were multi-level. Yes?
I have a two-part question. One is, are there these mystery schools today on the planet? And the second question is, I seem to have a difficulty in finding from regular literature the age of Bhagavad Gita. Is there anything in theosophical literature that gives its age when it was written?
We believe it was about 5,000 years ago, is that correct?
Which, the Gita?
Yeah.
The Gita?
No, it's very specific. It was the Gita was given out just before the death of Krishna, which was over 5,000 years ago. It was a gift to humanity for this cycle that we're in and was purposefully done.
5,000 BC or 5,000 ago?
5,000 years ago, which makes it, what, 3,000 BC. Yeah. But your first question, are there mystery schools? What do you think?
Today.
Yes?
Probably.
Well, mm-hmm. It's interesting. In the philosophy, it says that the mystery schools were initiated, first started, after the destruction of Atlantis. They're that old. Of course, they disintegrated and disappeared from public view a few centuries AD, but we read in Isis Unveiled, mm-hmm. and in the secret doctrine HPB referring to even throughout the Middle Ages certain disciplines and practices and secret societies and disciplines that disciples would go through. She mentions a few of those.
Yes, the Rosicrucians. And but if you stop and think about it for a minute, if you accept the premise that these beings that we're speaking about, these perfected human beings, exist, then why would they not continue in one way or another, however they could, no matter what is going on in that civilization, initiating in the sense of waking up those who are ready to be awakened? Have you ever gone to a movie or a play and felt something beyond your ordinary self, that you were getting some sort of food of the gods for the moment? So it is going on. It's in our literature. It's in our films and plays.
So for these teachers, we did not recognize them as teachers when they were there. It took us ages to kind of retrospectively to go back and say, mm-hmm. This is what they were talking about. So how do we now recognize such individuals and not wait another ages to go back?
Well, those who truly recognized them on the scene were those who were ready, who had carried the training forward with them from times before. And as it said, Buddha had 3,000 interested students, only 72 of which were ready or willing to...
Confucius, I think you said.
Was it Confucius?
I think you said that was Confucius.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think you're right. And I'm sorry, your question.
No, how do we recognize them at the time?
Right. Well, we would offer, what is it we are studying here? Mm-hmm. These are mysterious ideas, absolutely, especially when we're first encountering them in this particular lifetime. And we're searching and we're sifting through what was left for us in print, which are these mystical ideas. So this, in a sense, is a mystery school because we're working together to unravel these mysteries. And
to the extent that we recognize truth,
right,
when we see it. And remember, when the Buddha was on the scene, when Pythagoras, Confucius, Lao Tzu, they did have those who recognized them and knew them. And the same thing happened with the beginning of the Theosophical movement over 100 years ago. But what we know happens is people will take ideas and try to nail them down and make hard and fast rules out of them. Whereas what we're supposed to do is grow with them and through them. We wonder, does anyone remember the TV show Kung Fu?
Mm-hmm.
The young man coming to the temple and sitting out in the rain when all the others give up. And what might interest you to know, that young man was a student of theosophy at New York, mm-hmm. in New York, the young man who played the part on the film. The entire show follows that line of mentor more highly developed to student struggling and beginning. We think it's a very, very mystical thing. And we're sure if we were looking, we'd see that elsewhere too.
We were just thinking as to the recognition question. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we looked into the eyes of everyone we come across and treat them as if they have this wisdom within? Because they do. We're all on the path together. So one that stands apart would be for each individual to find and recognize. But if we treat everyone that way, how much good that would do, the impression that would leave.
And that's the expression, namaste. I salute that in you. Yes.
In terms of recognition, from the theme of our class, what we're trying to recognize is evidence of perfectibility.
Mm-hmm.
Perfectibility of compassion, power, wisdom. We don't think that it is their desire, from what we've read, to show forth their power, but certainly their wisdom and their compassion. And we think that that's not that hard to recognize in others, evidence of developed compassion,
mm-hmm,
or wisdom. So if we can see it around us in what we think are ordinary people that perfect themselves that way, it's easier for us to understand how that could be developed over many lives.
The fact is, if you really look, there is more evidence of compassion and altruism than of its opposite. The opposite seems to get all of the attention and the glory, but ordinary people are loving and kind and generous.
Is there any relation between the word compassion and companion?
Mm-hmm.
There's similar sounding. They've got most of the same letters.
Well, a companion could be one. You just choose one companion. But compassion should be universal. I don't know. It's interesting. Make a companion of compassion. That's good. Yes.
Well, look at the word compassion. Compassion.
Mm-hmm.
With
passion. Right.
With desire.
With passion for whoever you encounter.
Yes.
Yes.
Just to follow up on that interesting contribution, it is said that those who have earned the right to go into nirvana, those seven lives of effort, can willingly choose out of compassion to refuse it. And it is said they do it because of their sense of companionship or brotherhood with humanity. So we think the two are very much linked.
Absolutely. Okay.
And that wonderful line in Light of Asia, I booed who wept with all my brother's tears. It is compassion. But it is compassion based on knowledge. It's, if you know you are one with all that lives, it's no reach to be a companion to all that lives. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry.
I've always translated the word compassion as love and action.
Nice.
But due to the previous statement about recognizing these great masters and possibly learning from them, I used to think that if you're not meant to recognize them, then you won't. But on the other hand, I keep thinking about the parable that says that if when the student is ready, the master will come. So I'm kind of, ambivalent that, if I'm ready, they'll find me rather than, me finding them. Or that's what's going around.
But we think you're leaving out an important part. How does the student get ready? It's not ready if you're just sitting there saying, well, they're going to find me. Then you're not ready. So we think the first part of what you said is absolutely true. If you're not meant to recognize something, which is just like saying, if you and I are together in a class that maybe Edison or Tesla is teaching, you're going to understand what they're talking about. I'm going to be noticing their clothes because I don't have a clue what they're talking about. So you're going to get wisdom from the experience. I won't. And the difference is readiness. So if you're ready, then you will recognize. But the important thing we think is if you recognize, don't push it aside. Pull it to you. Study it. Try to digest it and understand what you can so you're ready for the next step. Okay. Yes.
I believe it was Confucius who said that all that we need know already resides within us.
Yes.
So
absolutely.
The idea of looking for a teacher without us is a little...
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, part of it is, as was said, the getting ourselves ready. And we remember hearing something like, the moment we turn to these ideas, our light, in a sense, begins to shine through. Maybe flickering at first, maybe a little stronger the more work we do on these ideas. But we are noticed on the plane of those who are looking for companions in this compassionate work. So one of the ideas given us to help bring ourselves to that point, to be ready, is called the divine discipline. Restrain by the divine the lower self. Restrain by the eternal the divine. Great is he who is the slayer of desire, still greater he in whom the self divine has slain the very knowledge of desire. Guard thou the lower, lest it soil the higher. The way to final freedom is within thyself. That way begins and ends outside of self. So this is the plane where we do the action, where we take up the sword, in a sense, and fight for these ideas and prepare ourselves for that day. Mr. Judge says, make yourself ready in every way possible so that when the time comes for you to take that step, you will be ready.
Pick one.
Yes.
Just to ask a question that turns the emphasis away from looking outside to within. What evidence do we have within ourselves that we are perfectible?
What evidence is within us that we are perfectible? Well, certainly the first thing that comes to mind is our school system, taking it to the physical plane. We, in everything we do, from a baby to an adult, we are perfecting ourselves, whether it's learning ethics and values given to us by our families, whether it's going through the school system and getting to higher learning, whether it's taking up a marriage or a relationship so that we can learn from another and offer to another. Everything in our lives is set in a way that we seek to make it better. Making it better is perfecting it. So it's in everything we do and everything we think, but we don't consider that being the same as perfectibility of these masters. It is. We shine with the same light that is within all of life. It's a matter of turning that on consciously and letting that be seen, and we have a better connection to it. All of that. Yes?
In the previous quote that you gave about restraining the divine by the eternal, it would seem to suggest that if we look within, we can find already within ourselves that perfection by which we can compare our current state with.
Yes, there is that which does not change. It is the resident with all that knowledge, with all those ideas gifted and implanted at the very beginning of our journey years ago in evolution, that witnesses the changes and work and enlightenment of the lower, because it is the lower that's acting and seeks to turn and act as the higher. But it is the higher that witnesses, that stays unmoved as we go through all these changes and uncoverings and enlightenments and so forth along the way. But that is eternal is that perfectibility.
Krishna said the same thing as you mentioned Confucius saying, you don't need the books. You will not find the answer in anything that's written because the answer already lies within you. So one has to ask the question, well, why did Buddha and Confucius and Krishna teach if the answer already lies within you? It's the problem is not that the answer isn't there. The problem is what we've covered it up with, our personal wants, our desires. We're born into a particular configuration of a certain type of mind and mental activity, a physical health and body, circumstances, education, all the things that we bring about to ourselves, and we blame them on everyone else. But the fact is that we come in with something that we pre-ordered, and it's that we have to push aside in order to get to that wisdom. Yes?
One of the things that we can look at and really observe and see our chance of perfectibility is our conscience. Mm-hmm. That which drives us, which haunts us when we know that we're doing wrong. It won't give us peace. It's almost as if it does stand outside of ourselves, because you might want to escape the pangs that you feel from it, but it continually stays with you. That is one of the things, one of the great guideposts that tells us that we're perfectible.
Well, it doesn't continually stay with you. If you shut it up enough, it will be quiet. What is it? Back to words, conscience, with knowledge, with wisdom. It's what you brought forward, known by experience. But you can silence it. You can shut it off. Or you can respect it and increase that knowledge and wisdom.
Yes. I think there was a hand in the back.
Going back a couple of comments.
Alex.
Why would we want to restrain the divine, and how? How do we? Why and how? I mean, it seems like we should let it work through us. Why should we restrain it?
What does it say to restrain it with? The eternal. It might be related to in the voice where there are the three different robes sublime, and if you are seeking to be divine, to be a witness to all of this, and not to be of service, well, then you're not going for what is eternal. It's still individual or personal. So we think, study it along those lines.
So going back to perfectibility, I think it's easier to see perfectibility in others. So as a parent, you see your child develop and grow, and you can see, you know, them perfecting over time. It's harder to see perfectibility in yourself for, you know, the reasons you mentioned. I think one of them also includes fear. You know, always self-judgment and kind of fear that you're not good enough. And then you keep yourself back from observing that perfectibility in you. But just like children, they perfect, you perfect as well. You don't acknowledge it yourself.
We think it's one of the most difficult ideas for us to learn about fear. That when we really truly accept and understand with all our heart that we are eternal beings, that the after-death states are the conduit for the next lifetime, that there is an endless series of lifetimes and cycles and beginnings and endings and forever. When we truly, truly, and that takes a lot of work, we think, really respect and understand that idea, there is nothing that we should fear. Now, the every human being has something they're afraid of, and it's something we can work on. And we work on it with those eternal ideas. I am divine. I have within me everything I need to work through these karmic conditions, and I can be of help and service to those around me. When you stand firmly in that, and I'm not saying it's easy, but when we repeatedly remind ourselves of these ideas, fear tends to fade away because it's changeable and of this plane and of no use to us at all unless we're in danger. Then it's, you know, absolutely necessary.
But back to the looking for perfectibility in ourselves, why? It's already there as a reality. We haven't manifested it, but why should we look for it? Better to look for little indications that you're moving in the right direction. Maybe you have a quick temper and you decide, all right, I am going to learn to control that temper. And then you realize, wow, I did. So you begin to note that. You're not looking for perfection in it. You're acknowledging that you're in control, that you have the power and the will to do so. And you keep moving in that direction. It isn't that we want to be perfected. It's that we want to be living the true life, which is the life of service. And if we are living that life, companions and compassionate, then perfection will arise on its own because we have cleared everything else. Yes, in the back.
I wanted to go back to the question about if this exists in us, why do we need others to come? Is this akin to the lighting up of Mass? Obviously, there has to be something within the human. It could be lit. It had to be an oil reserve within it in order for a flame to catch. Is this the same thing? We have it within us, but these avatars and wise ones come to ignite our imaginations to let us know what we can be. Is this the purpose of them?
We think that's a perfect analogy. Absolutely. We will go through the stage where mind is lit up. However, the voice of the silence reminds us that not only do we have to keep the wick clean and cut and so forth, in other words, we have to honor that flame in the sense of keeping it going and making it shine more fully. We honor it by doing that, and that is done in all the ways we've just talked about. Yes?
Well, to follow up on that, then, is it then the self-evidence that we have been lit up by another human being that helps us recognize that they're perfected or something, someone special through their own effort, that helps us recognize the teacher?
Yes, we think that's absolutely the truth. And don't we do that for one another? If we see someone in pain or suffering or in need and they come right to us, there's a duty recognized there, and we answer with compassion, we can lift, we call it lifting the spirits of another. It is sharing that flame, that fire, that warmth, that compassion. So we can not only recognize it in ourselves, but recognize it in another.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
So it seems to me that there's three types of people. Those
just three?
Those who do not, that they have a wick in them that could be lit. Those who believe they have a wick that could be lit, but haven't lit it. And those who have lit it. And my dilemma is, you know, believing that I have a wick is different than knowing that I have a wick, okay, that could be lit. And what I think of it is when they took Blavatsky into the mountains and held her there for 3 years, and they were lighting her wick for for me to light my wig, I have to stumble in quagmire and darkness for quite a long time.
Sounds like you're there now.
How to do that. And it's the how that bothers me. I do believe, but I do not know.
How do we know anything?
You live it.
How? I mean, take yourself back in your whole life. My favorite example is always riding a bicycle. You can read all the books in the world on riding a bicycle. You can know more about the bicycle than the person who invented it. But you're still going to have to get on that bicycle and learn the balance to make riding it possible. So what you're saying is there are people who know they have a wick, but they don't know how to light it. They just haven't gotten on the bicycle. What are they afraid of? What do they want? If we want wisdom and we're waiting for someone to convey it to us, the way we learned many things in school, we have a forever wait. It will never happen. We have to reach out and pull in and wake up those principles in ourselves that will make us recognize wisdom. There's more wisdom right around you at any given moment that you're overlooking because you're making assumptions about what's around you. This life is a mystery school, and the mystery is, why are we so stupid? What are we waiting for? We are the power of wisdom. Look within, thou art Buddha. Well, Buddha, you should be doing things that help others. There's a hand
Wait,
in the back.
1 second. There is another exercise we think that is perfect for what was brought up, and that is seeking in the mundane for the sacred, seeking the sacred in the mundane. So you say you don't feel as if you've been lit up, but knowing you a little bit, we know you have a family. So that had to be a sacrifice. We see you interact with other people in a very loving way. Seek in your everyday life for those moments when you're more than you thought you could be. How could you do that without that light of mind and compassion and love within you? You couldn't. You would be personal and selfish and guarded and fearful and all those other things. We fail to recognize in ourselves every day what's going on, and that's what these ideas are for, to wake us up. Your hand was up a long time.
Well, just to continue this whole idea of it's really in us, in each individual, and yes, it's fertilized by others, but I feel that there is a very powerful tool to reach within, and that is meditation. Mm. If we can access the stillness within, that emptiness, and I don't say that is easy, revelations sometimes come forward. And what did the Buddha do? He sat under the Bodhi tree for 40 years. Whatever, did not interact with anyone. He had it all in himself, and he knew that. And I believe we can reach that through meditation. And I do think that is difficult.
The only word that you mentioned we would change is the emptiness. And we thought of, from the voice, the fullness of the seeming void.
It's stillness.
Stillness is perfect, yes. Because everything is within us, always is within us. And it's meditation is a tool to reaching that, to having that become a conscious awakening.
It's simply the exercise of being able to quiet down enough in our busy lives to do that. But it works.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
I recently read something on the Buddha. It says that this time is completely forgotten by humanity. A new Buddha will be raised. And it occurs to me that it is an underline to the phrase that we hear in this room often. Humanity is never without a brother, without a friend. We are never left without someone to, or someone who will help us to light the path that we're on. But that recurring idea of Buddha struck me so, because the one in Afghanistan had to be there long before the Buddha that we...
What, you mean the statues?
Yes. That statue was very, very old.
Well, if you've ever read any of Pico Iyer's writing, and Pico Iyer's family are ULT people. He wasn't, but he wrote about those statues, and they were older than the races that we know of on Earth at this present time. So they were not of the Buddha. They never were. They represented older races and developments, and they were destroyed by those who are afraid of such ideas as freedom of thought or perfectibility. But
the same ideas that the Buddha held.
But the Buddha can never, we think, ever be forgotten. Many, many others might be, but we don't see how he could be forgotten just because of the example of his life and the beauty of the teachings he left. Yes. And it's bloodless.
It's what?
Bloodless.
Exactly. But the idea of another fulfilling that same, it's not that the mission
yes.
has changed.
Yes.
It's just that one comes and fulfills that same exact mission under that same title, regardless of what his personal name was.
Yes, the title means enlightened.
Right.
And that is
exactly.
the goal of every human soul, to be enlightened. And we may get enlightened a little bit every day. And that all leads to that final initiation.
And we are told, and this goes back to meditation, it is by dwelling on our inherent perfectibility that we get rid of our imperfections. Because we no longer then will see ourselves as beings incapable of anything. We are given the karmic due to what we set into motion, so we must be able to work through it. Was your hand up before?
That's the very question that I was going to ask. What role does karma play in helping an individual to pursue a certain path? It seems as though life is governed by cycles. And so when the time comes, the cycle will open and the individual will know, because we don't have all of this knowledge beforehand. The knowledge is acquired as we go along the path. So it would seem that the karma of the individual that would bring him to the point where he knows that he's ready to start pursuing the path.
Yes, absolutely. The karma we find ourselves with is what we need to wade through, in a sense, to get to the point that was spoken of, that we are ready, that all opens up before us. But that karmic work and those cyclic lessons must be done first, must be honored first.
But we're back to that earlier point about fear and looking at yourself, and you may decide to ignore the opportunity. And it is said it is then perhaps centuries, lifetimes, before another such opportunity comes to you. So whenever we see, I don't know, an opportunity to be compassionate, to be understanding, or to receive some new knowledge, in other words, to study something, to read something, we should take that opportunity. It's a karmic opportunity.
Did you have a follow-up?
I was simply going to state that it seems in our society today, most people do not have the strength or the courage to look at themselves. So if one finds oneself able to examine himself, that's really a plus.
Yes. Yes, the strength to truly look within is what we're working on developing. Absolutely. Yes.
As was just mentioned, if you focus on perfectibility, right, then all the imperfections will slough or fall off. So in effect, what is being said is you are what you focus on. If you meditate on reaching your higher self, then if you try hard enough and consistently and persistently enough, you will find it.
Yes. Absolutely, but maybe we should start with expectations that are achievable in the beginning. No, I'm serious. We first of all, starting meditation is a difficult thing if one hasn't before. Learning to quiet the outside noise and the distractions might be all we can do in the beginning. And maybe each day we add a minute to it, something like that. So, yes, the ultimate goal is understanding that within and feeling that lighting up and being able to do better. But we bloom where we're planted, so maybe we just seek to have the kind of day today that is useful and helpful and good for those around me. And if we can do that for 5 straight days and maybe make some notes, we look back and see where we had difficulty, that's a karmic lesson. And over time, if we keep these kind of notes, we see the cycle in action and we can prepare for it. All of that work leading up to that enlightenment. So perhaps we start with something like that. Well, we wanted to read to you from The Light of Asia, this ancient lovely text. To close the class. Pray not, the darkness will not brighten. Ask not from the silence, for it cannot speak. Vex not your mournful minds with pious pains. Ah, brothers, sisters, seek not from the helpless gods by gift and hymn, nor bribe with blood, nor feed with fruit and cakes. Within yourselves, deliverance must be sought. Each man his prison makes. Who toiled a slave may come anew a prince, for gentle worthiness and merit won. Who ruled a king may wander earth in rags, for things done and undone. Higher than Indra's you may lift your lot, and sink it lower than the worm or goat. The end of many myriad lives is this, the end of myriads that. I, Bude, who wept with all my brother's tears, whose heart was broken by a whole world's woe, laugh, and am glad, for there is liberty. Ho, ye who suffer, know ye suffer from yourselves. None else compels. None other hold you, that ye live and die and whirl upon the wheel and hug and kiss its spokes of agony. Before beginning and without an end, as space eternal and as surety sure, is fixed a power divine which moves to good. Only its laws endure. Meeting adjourned.